Recording in progress. Yeah, right.
don't
Whatever.
look like you're in your Scottish bolt hole today.
No, I'm at my mother's house in Hull. I've just been trying out my mother. Yeah, so there's my mother in the background. Yeah. She's trying to hide.
Hi, Saul's mum.
That's not actually my mother. That's a lady who apparently she masquerades as my mother. It's quite a strange syndrome. But I do come round to her house every few months and use her facilities. Yeah. It's, yeah.
Cool. Are we good?
Yeah.
Bro, right, let's get into it.
Manchester's indie rock and roll station, Access Manchester. The Excess Manchester Long Player, an iconic album in full with Jim Salverson. Excess Manchester.
I'm Jim, and welcome to the Excess Long Player, where I delve deep into the backstory behind some of the most classicist indie albums of all time. Today's album is a special one, and I think out of all the requests I get of particular LPs to cover, this is the one that I've been asked to do the most, and it is a beauty. The 1993 album from James, Laid. Saul Davis is going to be talking us through it. We're going to get all the stories from the inspiration behind the album to where it ranks in the James back catalogue, and how, if it hadn't been for producer slash musical legend Brian Eno, James would arguably have never had their most famous song. Plus, keep listening to this podcast, because as well as talking about that classic album Laid, there's a bit of a bonus on this show, because I also talked to Saul about the band's new album, Yummy. So that's coming up at the end of this podcast as well. But first, let's get stuck into the classic, shall we? As I talk to Saul about James's classic album, Laid. How are you doing, Saul?
Very well, yeah.
First off, thank you for talking to me about this album, because I know as a band, James have this reputation for not liking to look back too much, always looking forward, always developing, always doing something new. But we are going to look back today, and I wanted to start with, if push came to shove, if you had to look at the back catalogue for James, do you have a favourite album, and where does Laid rank on that list?
Wow, yeah. Well, I think, no, Laid is definitely right up there. I mean, it's probably, I think there are bits of Laid. If we were making it now, there's maybe a song or two that we would have potentially left off. We might have presented it slightly differently in terms of the running order of the record. That would be my view. Low, low, low probably wouldn't have made it on my new version of the record, but maybe, but maybe it needs to be there anyway as an antidote to some of the other stuff. I don't know, but it's a great record actually. And I, you know, it sounds a bit weird to say that about one of your own records, but I do think it's a great record. It has a timeless feel to it, which is because it was so, I think partly the songwriting is very good, but the production is fabulous, and it's just so simple and clean and just kind of like there, you know. So it's neither, it was neither in favour when we made the record, nor is it out of favour now. It's just, it's what it is, right? So it's a classic, almost acoustic record, which we've certainly not bettered, I don't think. We've spoken in the past about other James records, and Pleased to Meet You is a particular favourite of mine from our later body of work, post-2007. La Petite Mort, I think, is a great bristling rock and roll record, right? An amazing album. I love it. But Laid definitely stands the test of time, I think.
What's really interesting, I think, about this album and where it sits in the James catalogue is, and I guess this is kind of a hallmark of the band to a certain extent, is how different it is from the album that came before. As you said, it's almost acoustic at times. It's incredibly stripped back. Where did that decision as the band to do that come from?
It was a series of kind of just mistakes, really, that got us at that point touring with Neil Young acoustically, working with Brian. And Brian, and you know, it's the first time we worked with Brian. We made five, six records with Brian. And this was the first time we worked with him. So it felt very fresh and new. And, you know, we were like kids really in the sweet shop. And it was his contention that we needed to make a record where everybody could hear us playing, where nothing was hidden. So there needed to be not very much going on. And I think he wanted to put Tim's voice front and center of the record. And to do that again, we needed to create some space for it. So that we had a tendency to fill all of the space, which feels great in the room when you're doing it or on stage, right? But in a recording, it creates difficulties, even technical difficulties about hearing certain stuff. You know, I don't want to get too nerdy, but you can't have too much stuff in there, otherwise you don't hear anything, right? It's a curse of contemporary records, in my view, that we all fall foul of that, but because of the way that records are now made, less on tape as such, 24 tracks, 23 tracks, and into digital audio workstation systems, you can just, you know, record as many tracks as you want. So the tendency is to fill up everything. And Laid is certainly the opposite of that. There's almost nothing going on at points. And it creates it's a quiet record in the main, I would say. But it's a very powerful record because of it. And it's quite an intense record. But it is the sound of a band working together live in the studio. We made that record at Real World Studios, Peter Gabriel's place. And we set up in the big room there, and we were all in the room with each other playing, going directly to tape. Marcus Draves, who went on to make some very significant records with some great artists, was Brian's assistant, new assistant at the time. And Marcus was in another studio also recording us in the evening. So in the day we would work on what became Laid, and in the evening we would just jam incessantly with each other. And Marcus was overseeing that. And then he was getting those tapes and chopping them up. And Brian and he were, when no one else was looking or listening, were messing around with banks of H3000 Eventide machines, sending all of our music through these machines and chopping everything up and doing crazy stuff. And that record was made alongside Laid. That record became Wawa. So for James Aficiado's Wawa and Laid are actually accompanying records, although they didn't come out at the same time. The record label got Cold Feet. The idea was that the two records would be like an A and a B side to each other, right? And that didn't quite happen, and that confused a lot of people, which is why Wawa is often overlooked in some cases. But it's also a great record and comes out of the same sessions.
In terms of the direction of the record that Brian Eno took when he was producing it, and you mentioned he kind of like wanted to be able to hear the elements of the band playing, do you think that came from the way he was introduced to you as a band? Because I understand he was sent 6 hours of rehearsal tapes to go through before he'd committed to recording, and that was kind of what convinced him to get involved. So I guess listening to the rehearsal tapes, by their nature, they're a bit rawer, they're a bit more stripped back, and he could feel the bones of it. Do you think that's what led him down the path of going, well, look, we need to hear this. This is what needs to be on the record.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I think what happened, the first thing he heard was literally a cassette recording of people bashing around what became Sometimes. And I think it was a big moment. I think it was a moment for him, even for Brian. You know, he's worked on some of the most amazing records ever made, in my opinion. Not just in my opinion, obviously. And I think he heard that scratchy, almost indecipherable bit of noise and went, that can be something. I want to hear more. So he had more of these indecipherable, noisy tapes of just people bashing around and went, now this band has something. Let's do it. So, I mean, it was brave of him, I think, to come and work with us. But he understood something about the way that we weaved around each other and we communicated with each other with our instruments that he saw a huge amount of potential in. And he was right. We did 3 to 4 weeks of pre-production with him in a room in Manchester before going to Real World. It was in those sessions that I think he devised the plan of making sure that we were able to play the songs together. Okay, we might need to replace a little bit of an instrument here or there if somebody had fluffed the lines. But generally speaking, he was after whole takes. 5-0, which is one of my favourite songs on that record, I think is take 27, for example.
So is it quite a live album then in that case? Is a lot of that album as it was captured in the studio?
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and if you think back to that time, you know, and a lot of records were, right, still, you know, in many ways made in that way. I mean, this is not a big bristling pop record, right? It's a homely sounding, very beautiful sounding, wide open sounding still, not small sounding, but inviting. It has an inviting sound, doesn't it? Yeah, but bands were even into the night, you know, bands were still tending to work together live in the studio, looking for the drum take and then go back and build everything around the drum take, perhaps with a little bit of editing, depending on what system you were recording into. If you were recording into the Sony system, you could do a little bit more sophisticated editing. But remember, we weren't dealing with the kind of precision tools that we have now where you can edit every single hi-hat beat or every single millisecond of a record, right? That's why records sound so different now. They're so tight in comparison. So no, Brian was not looking for drum takes to then rebuild the songs around. He was looking for whole, complete performances. One or two elements may need to change within it, absolutely. And the vocals were all done, and BVs were all done separately. But yeah, that's where we. I mean, he was very careful with the overdubbing thing. It was like, oh, let's do this, let's do this, let's bang some strings on this. No, Brian would say, no, let's record Wah Wah. Let's drink wine and smoke rolled cigarettes, and then after dinner, get into the room and make Wah Wah, just jam. You know, so he used Wah Wah also as a way of keeping us away from the songs on Laid. He knew that we would overcook them. There was too many of us. We play too many instruments. We all play loads of instruments, but most of us play them quite badly. But that's not the point. We all have ideas that we can add and add and add and add. And that was the layering thing that we had done previously. And we still do to some extent. It's part of our James sound. But that's one of the reasons why Laid sounds actually quite different within our body of work.
I'd like to talk about a couple of really specific songs from this album, if that's okay. And then I'd like you to pick a highlight or from the album. A musical highlight, it could be, or could be just like a little moment that sparks off a memory or something like that. But the first track I just wanted to ask you about, and this might be one you struggle with, actually, because obviously I know Tim is the lyric man, and it was one of three, because I think in general, from what I hear when I listen to James' music, it tends to steer away from the politics and be more about relationships and people and feelings. Whereas One of Three, I understand, was influenced by the three hostages in the Lebanon in the mid-90s. So was that a bit of a step out of your comfort zone, tackling something political in music?
Yeah, he says that Terry Waite, being, he was chained to a radiator, wasn't he? And he was one of the three. I always took it to be Christ. Yeah. Tim would neither confirm nor deny.
All right. Okay.
That, yeah. I mean, I think it's quite open ended, that song, in many ways. And there are obviously, if it is about that particular situation, or even if it's about Christ, I mean, there's nothing more political, is there, than Christ in some ways. So, yeah. No, I don't think we're out of our comfort zone there. God Only Knows had been written and recorded and released by then, which was about the cult, the disaster of flirtation with cult, and about Jimmy Swaggart in America, who is a very influential, people might not remember, know even, depending on whatever. But Jimmy Swaggart was a very significant figure in kind of alternative religion, you know, right-wing nutter in America. And that song, God Only Knows, is in part about him and about that culture, evangelical American nonsense that, or, you know, from a British perspective, looks like nonsense, but whatever. And we'd also done Government Walls, Bring Down the Government Walls, also on Goldmother. Sky Is Falling had been recorded and released by then, which was a song about ecological disaster, impending ecological disaster, as was What For. What For was a song on Strip Mine, which references ecological disaster as well. So we were...
Essentially, what you're telling me is my premise is wrong, Saul. That's fine. I can accept that.
No, I think what I'm saying is that when I think about it, there's a history of the band bringing into our creative work some of the concerns that we have as individuals and collectively, you know, as people who think about the world and like to think of ourselves, people who would like generally to see a better world for more people, let's say. Yeah, so I think those lyrical concerns are there from early doors, actually.
We need to talk about Laid, obviously, title track of the album. And I understand that originally Laid, as far as the band were concerned, it was a bit of a throwaway track. It wasn't intended to be on the album. It was potentially going to be a B-side at some point. What changed it from being this track that you didn't really care about a whole deal to being front and center on the album?
Brian, who said, you are fucking idiots if you don't understand that this is your record. We're like, ah, shit. So we had demoed Laid at a studio in North Wales at the Windings, completely untogether, completely scrappy, the guitars out of tune, like whatever, thrown away. It was earmarked as a B-side. It was a demo in work in process, and we just never got it better than that. And that is the version that's on the album, and we just didn't give it any value. It was just too, it was too preppy, and it was too, you know, whatever. And it was Brian who identified it as having not only the commercial potential that it had, which is proved by its place in the world, you know, it's by far our biggest song globally, much, much bigger and much more well known across the world than Let Sit Down is, right? From a UK perspective, that would seem strange to say that, but that's how it is. And it was just too easy. It was too simple. It was too like, this doesn't do anything. And by the way, the lyrics are fucking ridiculous. And of course, all of those things were what made it, what make it special. It still stands up, very much so. And it has that riff, bang. It's just a field of 50,000 people just jump.
Yeah.
Whenever I start playing that, it's like, oh, we need people to jump. All right, we'll play that. They'll fucking jump. It's precisely the things that we felt that it lacked that interested Brian about the song. And he's right, right? He's completely right about it. We were like, we need to play it again. He was saying, no, 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 you've already got it. And we were like, no, 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 that's out. The guitars are out. They're all over the shop. And he was like, doesn't matter. That's the version. All right. Okay, then play it better. Play it. We played it. We played it better, technically. There's no soul. This is rubbish. He goes, I told you. That's your version. We mixed it. Tim banged a vocal on it. We're like, there you go. Done. The rest, as they say, is history.
Right. You've teased me for your album highlight already. So your favorite moment from
there's a moment in, and this is a nerd moment, but there's a moment in 5-0 about half the way through the song where on the drums Dave starts playing the tambourine. The tambourine was mounted on his hi-hat and he's playing the hi-hat and then he goes onto the tambourine, it clatters. And at that moment, just a quiet thing that happens is the most explosive moment musically for me, on not only on that record, but almost on any James record that we've ever done, where the elevation of energy and power and momentum that comes for the second half of 5-0 is all because of Dave's amazing idea just to hit fuck out the tambourine with some sticks. And it's just beautiful. And it, even talking about it makes the hair on my arms stand up. That's a nerdy thing for me about rhythms and stuff, but it's a beautiful, beautiful moment in the record. And anybody who likes to hear rhythm tracks and drumming and things should just listen to that moment. It's just beautiful and it's so effective. But there's a song that we almost never play it. I'm hoping that we'll try to get it together for our tour in the summer, though it doesn't necessarily lend itself to an arena audience, but perhaps it can work. It's one of the three. So we had the song existed and was very appealing and engaging to all of us and Brian, but we struggled to get a recording of it that made sense. And Brian actually was the only moment on the recording of Laid and Wah Wah where he was a bit like, I'm stumped by this, guys. I don't get it. I don't know what we're going to do. We couldn't get the pace right. We couldn't quite nail it. And we tried lots of recordings of it and we all had parts, but we couldn't make it somehow work. And it was the transition from the minor thing floating along at the beginning to we were one of the things, where suddenly Tim just belts out this huge major line. And it was like, we couldn't get a transition. Anyway, Brian left probably 2/3 of the way through the 6, 7, 8 week recording session that we had to make those records at Real World. And he left for the weekend to go back, went off on the train. And we all stayed and we said, right, fuck it. Let's nail one of the three while he's away. We're all sitting in the big room, I remember, and going, suddenly want to go, what are we going to do? And we're like, well, we don't know. So we just started playing it and we ripped it apart and we put it back together again and ripped it apart and put it back together again. And finally we ended up with that version and we knew, we looked around the room and went, we just did it. Mm-hmm. And we did it, not by charting it or writing it down, or we just did it by feel in the room playing. And it's such a moment in the history of my band. It's a hidden moment. It's an internal moment in a way. But it's a moment where I think we all realised in the room, wow, we play together, don't we? Look what we've just done. Look how we play together. When we put our, there's a clock going, it's telling me it's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And you're hearing, sounds like the trump tones or something.
You should be playing one of the songs off the album, really. That would be a nice moment, wouldn't it? If it went into the refrain from Laid.
It would be rather strange, given that I'm in my mother's house. As described before, the mother, woman who's not actually probably my mother, but I think she is my mother, and I come around occasionally and drink tea in her house and go away. Anyway. no, but it's so it and then I remember Brian came back, reappeared on Monday morning at the studio and goes, right, so what have you layabouts been doing then? Probably pissing around in the pond and drinking his stash of Rioja or whatever it was. And we were like, actually, we've been working. And he goes, go on then, play it to me. And he was astounded by what we'd done. And he was just like, lads, you did it. Wow. Amazing. And what a song. What a beautiful, beautiful song it is.
Love it. Sol, thank you so much for your time talking about this classic album. I know you guys don't do this very often, and so it's a pleasure to hear you talk about it. And I know that you just going back and looking through the mists of time at Laid will make a lot of people very happy. So thank you very much for your time on the XS Long Player.
Great. Thanks once again, Jim. Very nice to speak with you, as always.
Absolutely love talking to Sol about that classic album Laid. And as I said to Sol in the conversation, it's something the band do so rarely, it made it even more special. Hopefully that has inspired you to go back and listen to that classic album. And while you're there, make sure you listen to the band's new album, Yummy, which is an absolute stunner. Came out a couple of weeks back. And if you've not got stuck into it yet, make sure you do so. But first, as a bonus on today's podcast, here is Sol answering some of the questions that came in from XS Manchester listeners to me on Twitter about the brand new album Yummy. Tomorrow it's the big day. The brand new album from James drops. Yummy is out 12th of April, just a few more hours to wait. And ahead of that release, Sol from James joins me on the XS Manchester Evening Show. How are you feeling, Sol? Have you done this too many times before that you stop getting butterflies at this stage and it's just par for the course? Or do you still get nervous?
No, I don't get nervous at all. It's a sense of... Hello, by the way, and thank
hello.
You, as they say, thank you for having me. No, there's no nervousness. I think records are increasingly strange things to release because no one, no one, including me, after a certain point, people don't actually consume the record as it was intended, do they? They stick bits of it on playlists and chop it up and whatever. So actually, one of the things that we all started out doing many, many years ago, pre-internet days, was making something called an album, called an LP, a record. And they were delivered and listened to in the way that they were presented, you know. And so records start with, had side one and go to side two, or you flick the tape over, or whatever it might be. And there was some kind of idea, some kind of craft went into putting the thing together. I still like to think that we put our records together reasonably well, but... Yeah, I'm not quite sure how people will ingest this record or any record nowadays. It's very different. I feel less like we're putting a record into the world and more like we're putting a bunch of songs into the world.
We spoke fairly recently about this album. We chatted ahead of the Music Feeds gig. And so I thought instead of me asking you a load of the same old questions that I'd asked you before, I'd let some James fans, your public, ask some questions. So I put it out on Twitter.
Right.
I've got 64 questions in front of me. I'm not going to go through them all, but I've put them in a little grid.
All of them from Dave Brown.
I don't think I've got any from Dave Brown, actually. So what we've got 1 to 8 down one side, 8 to 8 across the top. And I thought we'd play a little game of question battleships. So if you can give me some coordinates, I'll ask you the corresponding question to those coordinates, if that works for you.
Six B.
That is Nicola Jackson, who asks the question, which song from Yummy can you see really taking off when it's played live?
Good question. Thank you, Nicola, for that question. Well, we had an experience a week ago, so now in Mexico, and we tried out 4 of the songs from this record. The first gig that we did, the second show we did was a festival, and there was no, we did one new song in the festival, but it was only an hour to play. But the night before, a couple of nights before, we played in Guadalajara. It was our own show. So we were able to spread our wings a little bit more, and we played 4 of these songs. And actually, I think all of us were very surprised by how easily they made their way onto the stage and held the room. It was really cool. There's a song called Life's a Fucking Miracle, which is going to be magic live because it's a big, bouncy, celebratory James song, quite typical probably of a kind of song that we sometimes do. And that will work. It'll work in a field. But there's a couple of other songs on the record which are probably where Nicola's going really with her question. There's a song called Shadow of a Giant and another song called Butterfly. And those two songs are also typical of a type of song that we do from time to time, which is more what we call... Well, it sounds a bit meh, this, but we call it our journey song. And that's just really a way of us being able to say to ourselves that those songs start in one place and end up possibly somewhere else, right? Over a long period of time. people who hate James will probably say, accuse us of being self-indulgent at those points. And the people that get us go, no, 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 that's why I like this band, right? Actually. So both of those songs, I think, fall very much into that category. And I look forward immensely to playing both of them. They're songs that will grow live more and more and more. And then probably one at some point into the playing of this record, we'll look back at the original recording and go, Christ, why didn't we record it like this? They're beautiful recordings, but in both cases, they're fabulous recordings. And for me, they're two real high points of the record. But nevertheless, they'll morph into something else, and we'll find new sections and other things will happen. And, you know, they'll become 10-minute opuses that, you know, and then we'll look down the set list and we'll be doing a festival somewhere where we've got 40 minutes and we'll go, right, we can do four songs. Somebody will turn around to me and go, we're not the fucking Cure. Come on, let's just get on with it. that's why it's so difficult to put those songs into the public in front of people that are not James fans, right? Because when you are on a festival and you have a truncated amount of time, you say, well, should we just go up there and play six songs realistically? Like some of these big, big, weird things like Sound. A lot of people be aware of our song Sound. Over many years of playing that song, it's morphed into being sometimes a 10-minute kind of thing, and where we genuinely don't know where we're going to take it that night, and ends up there's big sections in it which are completely identified as opportunities for improvising and jamming and going wherever we want to go, really. And that's when I think our band is at its very best.
Good question, Nicola. Thank you for that.
Yeah. So dreadful, dreadful answer. Fabulous question.
Next coordinate, please, Saul.
Well, we'll go 3C.
3C. Okay, this question is from Tim. He says, how long have James got left in themselves to keep doing this? Could Yummy be the last album, or are you going to do a Stones and continue till you're 80? And he says he hopes it's the latter. He hopes you're going to continue till you are all 80.
I'm not sure why Tim needed to go to the length of asking the question via you. He could have just called me up and we could have had this conversation. but I presume, therefore, that this is not Tim Booth asking this question. we're so distant from each other now. We only talk through...
It'd be a roundabout way of having that discussion, wouldn't it?
Well, Tim, it's down to you, mate. How long can you keep singing? I would say another good question, because in fact, on touches on something, a conversation that inevitably enough we have amongst our group from time to time, which is not how long would we like to continue doing this, because we don't see an end to that, but how long do we think even sometimes that we can continue to do this? And I think the key is whether or not we feel like, right, so there's a short way of answering this question, which is we'll just go as long as we possibly can until somebody else tells us to shut up. And then there's a slightly longer and more interesting answer, perhaps, which is, why do you want to be in a band in the first place? Why do you want to make music for the first place? Since in the case of James, going down the longer answer route, we never make music for anybody other than ourselves. And that is genuinely the case. And we don't feel pressure to do anything really, particularly, other than enjoy the music as much as we can that we actually make together. So when four of us get in a room and jam and make demos and start the process of making a new record, if we feel like that is going well, then we'll make a new record. And at the end, it will come out and we'll have to promote it and we'll have to take it to people, because that's a logical conclusion to the business that we're in, right? But we're a lot more, we generate a lot more material than we ever let people see, for a start. I mean, we do a lot of amazing music that I wish we could give to people. The deluxe version of this record, this is not a plug for this record at all. I refuse to plug our music. I think people should come to it if they want to come to it, and not if they don't want to come to it. It's that simple. But there is a deluxe version of this record, which people should share around with each other, in fact, and here, where we very bravely, and I think especially from Tim, a singer Tim, not questionnaire Tim, he's very bravely put our initial jams for 10 other songs on that version of the record. And I think it's very interesting because it will show people actually partly how we work and how we get from A to B. A, there's an initial jam, and then let's say attendant demoing stage. And these versions are just demos where Tim's vocal is in all sorts of states of undress, phonetic warblings and out of tune scratchings and all the rest of it, and bits of mad music that we're all trying to put together. If Radiohead did it, everybody would be all over it. But because it's us, people would probably just say it sounds really shit. Anyway, take from that what you will. But it's part of the answer to the question, which is if we are that creative ongoingly and we're making 30, 40, 50 demos for an album and we think they're actually all really pretty good, we just have to narrow it down somehow, why the hell would we stop? It's great to continue for ourselves, really, as much as anything. We've developed a really beautiful working relationship and it feels very solid. So I think we'll continue. It feels a little bit like our band is growing. This tour that we're doing in June was the biggest tour we've ever done in our career. I know one thing, that it's better to go out at the top, probably, than go out when you're sliding. But how many bands go out, have the balls to stop when they're on a high? Almost nobody, right? So I could see us going on for quite a long time. And in seriousness, it is also about whether Tim can deliver on stage and the rest of us, obviously. But Tim's the focal point, big vocalist, obviously. And at the moment, I would say his voice is better, as good, if not better, than it has ever been. It's changed over the years, but he's very powerful now. And it's a real privilege, actually, frankly, to stand on stage. For me, I find it a total privilege to stand on stage with everybody, but also with Tim belting out as he now does. So I don't know. I don't think age is necessarily a barrier to being creative. It's certainly not a barrier to being creative. Maybe being very elderly, there are natural physical barriers to touring, probably. But that one will hang. Time will tell, actually, where we end up. But this is our 18th studio album, 42 years, really. Jimmy started this band in 81, really, probably. So it's 43 years, really, a band. We had a hiatus of 6 years within that. But nevertheless, James has been in existence for 43 years. Can we get to 50? Yes, I certainly think we will.
A few miles left on the road. Yes, right. Let's do another question, Saul. What's your next coordinate?
2B.
Okay, this is from Graham McPhail. I'm not sure this is directly connected to Yummy. It might even be an in-joke that I'm not getting, but he wants to know which member of the band would win a triathlon.
Oh, well, I don't know if it's an in-joke. There's probably only two candidates for that. Well, there's one candidate. Jimmy would win it. I would come very close second. We're a band that like to keep ourselves fit. Tim does a lot of yoga-y stuff. Mm. He's wiry, but he's very strong. I do a lot of running. And Jim likes to hit things, punch bags and lift things. So between us, we'd probably do, if we could have, Tim swims quite well. Yeah, I could do the running. Jim could do the lifty stuff. And Tim could do the swimming stuff. We could have a bit each.
We can't finish on that one. So I think we need to do one more. Hopefully music-based question. So give us one more coordinate.
Yeah, that would be good. We'll do 8H. That will be the last one, won't it? The bottom.
Yeah,
one.
That's right in the corner. 8H is... Okay, oh, you might be familiar with these guys on Twitter. Tim Booth Lyric A Day have asked a question. Their question is, has anything in recent literature or television/media had an indirect or direct influence on the lyrics in the coming album?
Right, well, that's a Tim question. I can't answer that. Tim is our wordsmith. Mark, myself and Jimmy are doing the music. And
sure.
Tim is making the words. This record, you've heard this record. This record flits around all over the place, lyrically, like all of the records do, and musically, like all of our records do. There are a whole myriad of different reasons why those lyrics exist. Some of them are political, some of them are personal, some of them are obviously. We have shared concerns, we have our individual concerns. The lyrics come from all of that stuff. There will have been something, no doubt, in the background that will have spurred Tim on to write some of these, where, you know, lyrics Tim has ongoing. We all do have our ongoing favorites in terms of music that we listen to and art that we consume and literature. You know, Doris Lessing, I guess, for Tim, he often cites her, Patti Smith. You know, we all listen to The Doors, we all do, you know, whatever. There's a shared language that we have between us, but specifically what those lyrics are coming from, I can't say. So I'm going to perhaps we pick another quick one, which would be 6H, nearby but different.
Okay, let me find 6H. So 6H is... Oh, this is interesting. So Phil Tight says, are James a better band for having gone through the split and reformation, and did that time apart, did it add to the band?
Yeah, probably. Well, simply we can't know. Certainly what I suspect is that we would have, if we had continued going further into 2001 and beyond, which is when we split around Pleased to Meet You, which is, in my view, is one of our top three records that we've made. And when I said earlier that bands tend not to end on highs, actually, I think Pleased to Meet You was a high for the band. But in the background, we were imploding and collapsing. And so it was unsustainable. If we had continued for whatever reason, then we would have car crashed completely. We were in the process of it was a slow car crash, perhaps. So actually, the split was necessary. Whether we were a better band or not, we are a band, and we would not have been otherwise. I wonder whether, though, in any environment, you know, whether even within personal relationships, you know, and work, in your work, whatever, it's good to have breaks sometimes anyway, I think. I suppose we're not very good. Our world doesn't quite work like that often, but yeah, probably. It certainly gave us an opportunity to revisit our relationships personally with each other and discover what we liked about ourselves. Although it was a bit wobbly when we got back together in 2007, I think we wrote some good material.
It was like starting again.
Yes, a really good question to which there's no definitive answer. But one thing is worth saying is whatever we've done between us since 2007, and as anybody who follows James will know, you know, we also had change of personnel during that time as well. So the band has not been static within this period. And so I think one of the reasons why we feel very good with each other and we enjoy our work together and we enjoy each other's company so much is because actually those guys have brought also a freshness to what we're doing. I think that's quite important to recognise as well. Actually, they're very much part of why we are where we are, so buoyant with each other, actually.
Well, new music sounding as fresh as ever. The album is one of my favourite James records, I think, ever. I think it goes right into the top few in the collection, and I can't wait for the world to hear it tomorrow. But Saul, thank you very much for your time talking to us on XS Manchester.
Yeah, great. Thanks very much, Jim.
XS Manchester Long Player, an iconic album in full with Jim Salverson. XS Manchester.
A pleasure and a privilege to talk to Saul on this episode of the XS Long Player. Make sure you get stuck into the back catalogue. If you are new to this podcast, there's loads of conversations with brilliant people about some of their amazing albums. No doubt your favourite albums have been covered already, so take a look and see what we've got. And if your favourite album hasn't been covered yet, well, get in contact. You can leave a review on Apple Podcasts, tell me what album you want to cover. You can leave a comment on Spotify, or you can get in contact with me directly on Twitter at Mr_JimBob, and I'll do your favourite album on another XS Long Player.
The XS Manchester Long Player, an iconic album in full with Jim Salverson.
XS Manchester.